I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food here on KCRW and KCRW.com. We'll find out the results of the fish census today on the show. I'll take you on a road trip to Lonchera Lane in Santa Ana with Gustavo Arellano. I'll tell you how to make Mexican hot chocolate at home. Chef Eric Repair is here, plus Jonathan Gold has a restaurant for us to try. But before all that, let's head out to the Santa Monica Farmers Market to see what's fresh and in season this week in Southern California.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. Blueberries are one of the darlings of the food and nutrition world, and it seems like these days you can't get enough blueberries in your diet. We are lucky to have several blueberry growers at our farmers markets here in Santa Monica. John Jackson comes down from Whitney Farm in Carpinteria, which is just south of Santa Barbara, and you are here with these lovely 6-ounce baskets full of plump blueberries. Can you tell us about the varieties that you have?
We have, actually, in the ranch, we're growing about 6 to 8 different varieties at one time, and we bring down different varieties at different times of the year. Right now we're bringing down Star and Emerald. One's a little bit tartar than the other, one's a little bit sweeter than the other, one is a little bit larger than the other. So you have kind of a different variety, and we tend to give you a mix in each clamshell, in each 6-ounce clamshell. They're all fresh. We keep them very refrigerated, very cold. So when you eat them, you get a nice little pop of freshness, which is excellent.
Yeah, now these are harvested off of low bushes.
Yes.
And if anybody's ever seen a blueberry field and then complains about the price of the blueberries, just go out and try to pick a bunch of these from about 2 feet off the ground.
It's very labor intensive.
Yeah, right. And you have to pick them ripe, and they have to be dark blue. You don't want to see any, like, red,
no,
or
redness,
you want to see blue all the way through.
Correct.
And the season, it's funny because they seem to come and go. I know that Whitney Ranch got a little bit of a late start this year. There was another variety from another grower that came in a little earlier. So everybody's growing different varieties. They're all coming in at different times.
Absolutely.
So we're hoping. Now, how long will you be here now with this harvest?
Last year we were here through the second week in July. So I think we'll probably be here through July again this year.
Okay, John. Well, thanks so much. And the blueberries are delicious.
Thank you, Laura.
It's never too soon to be thinking about barbecue. And I was so inspired talking to private chef Dave Rubel the other day. And he was talking about a dinner he was planning. And they were going to be doing a nice outdoor barbecue in the cold. But what was really exciting was all the amazing side dishes you were talking about. You've had about 6 or 8 fabulous-sounding side dishes.
Well, you know, here in California, we love barbecue all year round. And, you know, this past President's Day weekend, I was out in the desert, and one of my clients asked me to do a barbecue for them and their family. Being winter, we just decided to go in a different direction with all the side dishes. Yeah, we had all the usual meats, steak, ribs, fish, etc. But then taking the winter vegetables, I came up with a bunch of different side dishes, like a wonderful fingerling potato that was grilled with caramelized cipollini onions and chanterelles with a little bit of dill. And it was absolutely fabulous. And people are very often kind of intimidated by cipollinis because they don't really know how to work with them.
Well, to describe what it is first.
Well, a cipollini onion is a tiny Italian onion that is kind of flat on the top and a little bit domed on the bottom. And people are afraid of peeling it because if you peel it raw, you wind up with not much of the onion left.
Right.
So what I like to do is just snip off the top and drizzle them with olive oil, a little salt and pepper, and a touch of sherry vinegar. And then I'll put them either in foil all closed up or in an oven-proof pan covered with foil and roast them off for about an hour and a half.
How high?
I usually do them about 350.
Mm-hmm.
And that way they caramelize, and as all of that sugar comes out, it mixes with that touch of sherry vinegar and develops this wonderful sweet and sour complexity.
Mm-hmm.
And then after they're done, let them cool, and you just squeeze the outer skin. And not only does the skin all come off, but the root end just pops right off, mm-hmm. and you wind up with this absolutely gorgeous little onion. Then I toss those with some Alex Weiser fingerling potatoes, which I had parboiled, and then threw on the grill, little salt and pepper and olive oil, once again.
Whole? You just do them whole?
I usually split them in half after I parboil them.
Okay.
And
peel,
I throw them on the grill.
Peel.
I don't peel them. I throw them on the grill, just get some color on there. Then I toss the cipollinis, the potatoes, in with some cut-up chanterelle mushrooms, which I still leave raw. Of course, chanterelles need to be cooked. But then I take all of this, sprinkle a little bit of dill in there, salt and pepper, throw them in the oven for about 15 minutes, and this dish is just fabulous. And, of course, it's a classic winter vegetable side dish, which is perfect for a winter barbecue.
Winter barbecue with winter vegetables. It just sounds fantastic. Thanks so much, Dave.
Thank you.
That was Dave Rubel. He's a private chef who comes to the market every week and does quite a bit of cooking around town and is always so inspiring with these recipes. So I'm taking notes and I'm going to go get a bunch of vegetables and have my own winter barbecue. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
A recipe from Dave Rubel is at kcrw.com/goodfood. And see pictures of the blueberries on sale at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
Roast pecan cornbread. Hey, hey, hey. Roast pecan cornbread. Yeah. Roast pecan.
When you talk about food, you're usually talking about really, really positive feelings and memories and people coming around the table in a very sort of open, loving, celebratory way. But there's a whole other side to food, food justice and food injustice. To take a look at the issue of justice in the food industry and beyond, we've invited Professor Robert Gottlieb from Occidental College. He, along with his co-author, Anupama Joshi, have just co-authored a book called Food Justice. It's wonderful to have you here.
It's good to be here, Evan.
It seems that just as right now there seems to be a tipping point for the celebration and interest of food, Food Network, and just how people seem to now be participating and learning about food as an entertainment also. On the other side, there seems to be a force that's building an emerging movement to support the work for food justice. Can you sort of talk a little bit about that emerging movement and some key either cities or players?
Well, one of the things that's, I think, really important about the food justice movement is that it's changing the way we think about the efforts to change the food system. And the parallel we make is with what happened with environmentalism and the rise of the environmental justice movement. A lot of people thought of environment was kind of a niche idea that only people who could go out and hike the Sierras really were concerned about the environment. And the environmental justice movement said, no, no, this is about where we live, work, and play. Similarly, I think there was charges that the food movement was really a niche movement. It's only for the folks who can afford high-quality food that it was about. And the food justice movement comes in and says, no, food is about the issues that everyone faces. It's about our daily life and where we access food and how we eat our food. And so it's really shaping both the food movement itself and shaping the way we talk about food. And so there are places around the country. We profile a group, for example, in New Orleans called the Rethinkers, a bunch of middle school kids who, after Katrina, decided they wanted to do something about their schools that were in such rotten shape. And after a year or two of mobilizing and organizing, they really focused on school food. And they learned about the food issue. I mean, these are 12, 13, 14-year-old kids who decided that the way to reshape their school food was to adapt, in effect, to a food justice strategy, bring in local food, support the local shrimpers, create school gardens, do things that really changed the dynamic for how kids were going to encounter food in their schools.
Let's talk for a moment about where we live here in L.A. County and environs. You and I have both been part of a process to create a Los Angeles Food Policy Council, which has just come to pass. We haven't even had our first meeting yet. And we see this going on in many other cities across the country. What is a local food policy council? And what
do those who have created them hope to achieve through them?
Well, it serves a lot of different functions. Food is typically not dealt with in the policy world at the local or regional level. So the Food Policy Council idea was really an attempt to say, wait a second, it's where we experience the food system that where you really have to intervene. There's often a disconnect between the people who are making changes on the ground and the people who are doing the policy. So Food Policy Councils are an effort to make that link between community-based organizations, the people doing work in schools or in the workplaces and in communities, and connect them to policymakers.
And where does the conscious consumer sit in all this? So much of this work is work of policy, but how can individuals help?
Well, we get that question all the time. Obviously, the most direct answer has to do with how people individually confront the food in their daily lives in terms of what they source, where they go, what they do. But the deeper issue is thinking then about the places where they live, work, and play, and whether there can be changes that they can have and make happen in their community. For example, there's a new initiative to create a food co-op in the Pasadena-Altadena area. That's a different kind of a strategy in terms of how you can access your food. Can these spread? Well, individuals make that happen.
It has been so great to have this time to talk to you. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Robert Gottlieb is Professor of Urban and Environmental Policy and Director of the Urban and Environmental Policy Institute at Occidental College. His new book with Annapurna Joshi is Food Justice. After this short break, we'll hear from Jonathan Gold. The Pulitzer Prize winner has a restaurant for us to try. Stay tuned. You're listening to Good Food. Welcome back to Good Food. I'm your host, Devin Kleiman. I love it when Jonathan Gold stops by because then I can start thinking about lunch. Jonathan, of course, is the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly, and he's here every week with a restaurant recommendation. Today, we're going to Koreatown.
Well, I decided not to do the Pig Trotter restaurant this week. You'll get it soon.
Okay, it's something to look forward to. But in lieu of Pig Trotters, what will we be having?
This will be a duck specialty restaurant.
Interesting. So what do Koreans do with duck?
Koreans do apparently a lot of things with duck. There was that famous or almost famous restaurant called Ilsan Duck that was here. That was a branch of the first one in Korea that did this elaborate stuffed duck. This restaurant, which is called Sun Ha Jang, is not elaborate. They basically do one thing with duck, and it is grill it.
Grill it. Now, do we grill it or do they grill it?
Oh, we grill it. You sit down, or you probably wait because there are way more people who want to eat duck than there are tables equipped to cook you duck. You're brought the usual punch on the small dishes, which are not the most distinguished ones you're going to find in Koreatown now. You know, the cabbage kimchi and pickled turnip and bean sprouts and a couple other things. Depending on what you've ordered, they bring out duck.
Raw?
Raw.
With skin?
With skin. With fat. Oh, with fat.
All together, so it isn't like there's a breast which has been skinned and then the skin is separate. It's entire?
Entire. So they take an entire skin breast and they slice it thickly and they roll it into kind of a roulade, like a round shape. It looks like pancetta. There's a special grill on the table. It's cast iron. The flames don't hit it directly. It just heats up the surface. It slants so that a lot of the duck fat goes in the direction where you want the duck fat to go, away from the meat.
Which also prevents you from catching on fire.
Yes, that would be a useful thing for it to do. You put your duck on it and it grills. When it's sufficiently brown or is at the point where you want it to be, which is more than you probably think it's going to be at first, because this isn't the delicate magret you're going to get at a French restaurant. This is slabs of duck. And then there's all kinds of things to dip it in or to wrap it into a sort of a lettuce bundle with shredded pickled turnip and bean paste and whatever else you want to wrap in there, raw garlic.
So they take the duck breast, put the skin on, they make a roulade of it. Mm-hmm. Is all the skin exposed so that as it's grilling you get a lot of crisp skin, or is some of the skin on the interior of the roulade, so some of it is flabby?
Some of it is on the interior, so yeah, it is a little bit flabby. You don't get the complete crisp experience that you want. This is on the menu as sliced duck. Then you could also order something called roast duck, which is not roast duck at all. It's the part of the duck that isn't the breast, which is cut up in pieces that are somewhat less neat and brought to the table exactly the same way.
That seems like that would be more interesting in a certain way.
In a certain way, it is, because there's more different textures involved. When you do it, the waitress like fixes the big grilling thing so that, in fact, it's not on a slant anymore. And there's a drain at one end with a little spout. She plugs that up with a piece of kimchi. That would be the only way you do that.
I love that.
And when you get the roast duck, what you're essentially doing is rendering duck fat in real time. And as you know, it takes a while.
It does take a while. So while that is happening, what are you eating?
Well, if you've gotten the first kind of duck, then you might be eating the first kind of duck. If not, you're waiting for it. There's not a ton of other things on the menu. I mean, I've gotten a kimchi jjigae a few times. Everybody can stick a spoon in that. And you have conversation and you drink a lot of soju and you wait for the duck to render.
What is the kimchi jjigae for people who have never had it?
It's halfway between a soup and a stew. It's flavored with sort of old kimchi. Old meaning it's been around for a while and it's gotten very strong, very tart. This restaurant also serves a lot of beef, or a certain amount of beef. So you can get a set dinner with your galbi and with your bulgogi and with your intestine. Usually there's one person out of, say, 10 parties in the restaurant that will get the beef instead of the duck. Eventually, your duck will render. At this point, there's probably, at least a pint, somewhere between a pint and a quart of sizzling, roiling duck fat in a reservoir at one end of this thing. And when you've pretty much eaten and your duck has crisped up to as much as it's going to crisp up and you're feeling full, a waitress comes over with a container of purple rice. The rice itself probably isn't purple, but it's rice that's been cooked with beans and just turns bright purple. And she dumps that out and she adds some sesame and she adds some scallions and she adds some chili. And she stirs in a lot of that slivered turnip thing that you've been presumably wrapping into the bundles with the duck. And you have duck fried rice that is probably about half duck fat by weight.
Unbelievable.
It's really good. You wait for it to crisp up so it gets like frizzly and crisp on the bottom and crunchy. And it's steamy and almost fluffy on the top. And it tastes really good. It's something you should probably eat maybe once every 6 months or so.
While you're taking an extra Lipitor.
Exactly.
I mean, one of the parts of the Korean self-grilling experience is de-stinkifying yourself when you go home. I would imagine that this duck experience just brings what everybody in the car smells like on the way home to another order of magnitude.
You smell a lot like roast duck. One of the funny things is that the third thing on the menu is the one that you would almost instinctively go towards, which is spicy duck, which is the sliced duck only tossed with chili and bean paste and garlic. It's pretty good when you eat it, but the chili paste chars really easily. at the end, when you make the fried rice, it's just terrible.
That's interesting. So it's something that you would normally gravitate to, but maybe you should think twice before you make that choice.
I would, right. I would definitely go towards, you know, getting them sliced and then the roast.
We've been talking about Sungha Jang on Olympic near Crenshaw. Get the exact address sent to your cell phone by texting the words good food to 69866. That's good food to 69866. And find all of Jonathan Gold's restaurant recommendations on the Good Food Restaurant map. It's on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. One of the few food cultures in the U.S. that continues on with unbroken links to the past is the food culture of New Orleans. Calas are one of the great delicacies of this vibrant culture. Giselle Perez is an expatriate New Orleanian living in Los Angeles. She owns a catering business called Small Pleasures Catering and blogs about food. Calas connect her to her home city.
Calas are a rice fritter, traditionally a yeast-raised dough, although later versions were made with baking powder. They were sold throughout the street by street vendors in the 19th and early 20th century. Women would walk through the streets calling out, "Belle show calas here." And, you know, New Orleans has a culture of street vendors, food street vendors, which is really nice. And there's still a few that survive today, not selling calas, but other things.
And I understand you actually had a great-grandmother who sold them.
My great-grandmother sold them along with a few other things. But, you know, I'd heard stories about her all my life. My mother told me, my mother's cousins, that she used to gather up all the girls in the family and they would go out and sell them early in the morning. They would go to they had a what they called a fisherman's mass at 5 a.m. in the morning, so they would go to the church and sell them there. They would go sometimes to the bars where the revelers were just finishing up for the night. They would just go wherever they could find throughout the neighborhood and sell calas along with her other little delicacies.
Tell me the cry again. What did they say?
They would say, "Belle show calas, beautiful hot calas."
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, describe the dough. Is it made with really super cooked rice that's kind of in a liquidy form?
Very cooked rice, very soft rice. I think initially they were made with leftover rice because, you know, rice is served with every meal in New Orleans, and they would add water to it. But I had the opportunity a couple of weeks ago to go and make them with one of my mother's cousins who's in his late 80s now, and he was great. And he cooked it till it was like, I mean, almost like a juk, you know, very, very soft.
Like a porridge almost.
Yes, like a porridge, definitely.
So you have this this very soft rice, a little bit of flour, yeast. Are there eggs?
Sugar, eggs, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, they're tasty. And a lot of nutmeg he put in his, a lot of nutmeg.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
How are they different from beignet in the culture?
Beignets don't have rice. I don't know if beignets were initially made with yeast or not, but now beignets are pretty much always made with baking powder, as far as I can tell. But they're very similar. You know, people would take calas out to the Mardi Gras parades, and they would also take beignets and some other kinds of donuts and fritters, just depending on your family tradition, you know. So they're very similar.
When you're in New Orleans now, are there commercial outlets where you can actually buy calas?
Very few people are making them anymore at all, which is sort of, you know, my mother had told me these stories. I had no memory of them, although she told me that they were always served for First Communion brunches. I posted a picture last week of calas on my Facebook page, and I have never, never gotten so many comments. And I had several people write and say they had not seen them since their First Communion or since their grandmother made them, you know. So they've just kind of, for some reason, they've fallen out of fashion. I was in New Orleans a couple of years ago, and I was staying with an older family friend, and she told me that her mother used to make them, and they would take them out to watch the parades when they were kids on Mardi Gras Day, and my ears perked up. So I just really wanted to learn about them and learn how to make them because there's so few people left making them.
Do you know certain pockets of New Orleans culture here in LA that some of us wouldn't know about?
Well, when I was a child, there was a very, very strong pocket. They've dispersed somewhat now. There was a whole enclave along Jefferson Boulevard, and actually some people in New Orleans have written about this. So just a real traditional immigrant kind of community. There were New Orleans restaurants, New Orleans fish stores, bakeries. Pretty much everyone I knew as a young child was from New Orleans. It was a very strong community.
What's one of your favorite restaurants to go to in town?
In Inglewood on Prairie Avenue, it's called Bourbon Street Fish. I think they make the best gumbo. And I think I go to Uncle Darrow's. I'm a friend of Norwood's, and I love their shrimp po' boys. I think they make some of the best shrimp po' boys, even better than some in New Orleans. So,
thank you so much, Giselle.
Oh, no problem.
Fat Tuesday is March 8th. When Good Food returns, we'll find out the results of a fish census. That's in 1 minute. Stay tuned. You're listening to KCRW and KCRW.com. I'm Evan Kleiman, host of Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. There isn't only a census of people, there's a census of marine life, too, and that one takes a global squadron to do the counting and categorizing. Dr. Paul Snellgrove of the Ocean Sciences Center at Memorial University in Newfoundland was one of 2,700 scientists from over 80 countries who contributed to the research. The Census of Marine Life recently released a report documenting some unusual findings in the water. Dr. Snellgrove is joining us this morning to let us know if it's safe to go in the water, and if so, should we wear a lobster bib?
Hello.
Hi, it's so great to talk to you. Could you explain to us how the Census of Marine Life started?
It began as a simple meeting between two people in around 1996. A scientist by the name of Fred Grassley went into the program officer of Jesse Alcibel, who worked at the Sloan Foundation, and lamented the fact that there had been a lot of interest about ocean diversity, but nothing had really happened in terms of a research program. And so they chatted about this for a while and hatched what would eventually become the Census of Marine Life. And it ended up being this massive program that you described, which is truly global in its scope.
What was cataloged?
Well, just about everything. So there were experts on the census working on everything from microbes all the way up to fishes and even marine mammal specialists. And so the census was really about diversity, distribution, and abundance. And so the different types of life in the ocean, where they live and where they move, and how many of them are in the different parts of the ocean.
I would imagine that it's sort of easier to track a microbe than it is a large whale.
Actually, that's an interesting thought, because in fact, the technology right now is very good to be able to attach satellite trackers to different types of marine mammals and different types of fishes. And so particularly a group in California based out of Stanford has been really successful at tracing everything from tuna to loggerhead turtles to elephant seals. Trying to actually follow a microbe is really very difficult, actually, because you can't attach any sort of transmitter to it. And so knowing where it goes is really a very difficult question.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, I understand that there is something called the big wet secret. What is that?
Well, I would say that that's the large area of the ocean that we know truly nothing about. And so one of the things that we did in the census was try to amalgamate whatever data sets are out there And we didn't get them all, but we got many of them. And we put it into a central database, which is available for anybody to go and download and look at where life is in the ocean. But what it shows us is the gaps. And the hugest gap is actually the deep ocean, the midwater portion of the open ocean. And so we sampled some things on the seafloor in the open ocean, not a whole lot, but almost nothing in the waters above it. We know, for example, that there are about perhaps a quarter of a million known marine species somewhere in that vicinity. But we think that for everyone we know about, there's probably at least 3 to 4 we don't know about. So there's still lots of secrets in the ocean.
What were some of the more unusual findings?
Well, of course, that's a perception thing. And my own perception, some of the unusual findings were, first of all, not just that we found new species, but in some cases, some of these new species were big. I mean, a lobster is more than 3 kilograms in weight, kelps several meters long that were unknown to science, in the many years we've studied the oceans. And then the other thing that I found really very surprising was the degree to which we've changed the oceans even before we realized that we were doing it. Like many of us, I think, I tend to view human impacts on the oceans as being on the scales of decades, perhaps. But in fact, we now know that in some areas, these impacts began thousands of years ago, and that really the Romans were the first industrial fishermen.
Let's go back to that lobster for a minute. Could you describe this giant lobster that was found?
Yeah, so this was a phone call a scientist in South Africa received, and some fishermen were trying to get a permit to export some lobster they had caught, which they had identified as European lobster. And the South African scientists knew this wasn't right, so they went and checked it out, and lo and behold, these lobsters, more than 3 kilograms in size, had never been seen by scientists before. And so the fact that we can still find species, even in relatively well-known waters, tells us that there's still tremendous potential for discovery.
So what would the length of something of that weight be?
Let's say about the length of your arm from the tips of your fingers to your shoulder, along that sort of size.
I understand that you used some old seafood restaurant menus and even ship journals in some of your research.
Well, that's right. I mean, the census had a program called the History of Marine Animal Populations, which is trying to look at the oceans before we had scientific data. And so, for the most part, scientific data really only begins maybe in the 1960s, sometimes post-World War II, but very little before that. So trying to figure out what the oceans looked like before we started collecting this standardized data is a really difficult process. And so what this group has done, which I think is really intriguing, is to use any bits of information they can locate to try and get a view of the oceans. So you mentioned ship logs, for example. So in Columbus's logs, he talks about the abundance of sea turtles in the Caribbean, but now they're really rare. And so the fact that these things were once so abundant that Columbus would note them in his journals tells us that the oceans really look fundamentally different than what they did today. And the same is true of paintings, for example. We can see what was being sold in fish markets. We can look at, as you mentioned, restaurant menus, which tell us what was being sold, which presumably was available, and in many cases are things that are no longer available in the waters near where they were being sold at that time.
Did you find things that are edible that aren't yet eaten?
I suspect some of these things are probably, well, they certainly are edible. Now, whether they're in sufficient numbers to be sustainable is another question. But yes, certainly some of these things could be eaten, and they may also interact with things that we eat. That's one of the other big unknowns, is that you have all this diversity out there. What's it doing, and how does it affect the species that we care the most about?
So now that you've created this census, which I would imagine now is an ongoing project and which will just keep being added to, is there a danger that certain areas or certain species will be actively sought out for food and create more endangerment rather than more protection?
I think that's absolutely a danger, and so, you know, with knowledge is power, but that power must be used wisely. And so one of the things we have identified are what we've been calling blue highways of migration in the oceans, and these are particular routes along the ocean which organisms travel, and certainly one could use those highways to try and catch more fish. So I think what we have to do is to take that knowledge and make sure that if we do start extracting from these locations, that we make sure we do it in a sustainable way. And that really is tricky because many of these highways, of course, cross international borders.
So fascinating. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Good to talk to you.
Chef Eric Rappert is one of the most respected chefs and cookbook authors. His Le Bernardin restaurant is an ode to fish. It's also swimming in stars, 3 from Michelin and 4 from the New York Times. One reason why I think the restaurant is so respected is because of Eric's relationship with his ingredients.
I always thought that the quality of the ingredients have a huge influence in cooking. And I always say to my cooks, if you start with mediocre ingredients, you will end up with a mediocre dish. And it's very true for seafood, actually. I mean, if you start with fish that is stinky and smelly and you try to cook something with that, nothing will hide those very bad smells and flavors. Now, if you start with a fish that is pristine, then you will be able to cook something that is potentially amazing. I believe in the quality of the ingredients, but not only for seafood, it's for fruits, vegetables, meat. Everything should be of high quality. If you have fruits that are not ripe, whatever you want to do with it in terms of baking or cooking or eating, it's not going to happen. They won't taste.
A few times a year, you take time to travel, and particularly now with the PBS show and this book, Avec Eric, which comes from the show. You seem really fascinated by the place that food has in terms of the geography and culture of particular places. And I find it really interesting that the places that you've centered on so far seem to be sort of Mediterranean-inspired or warmer, like California, Italy, central Italy, and also the Cayman Islands.
I choose those destinations because I had some good contacts and because they are beautiful and inspiring and because they're very rich in terms of ingredients. And they are inspiring because of the natural beauty of the surrounding. I strongly believe that the surrounding and the seasons and the ingredients are true inspiration for cooking. You go out, you talk to people who are at the source of the ingredients. I was with farmers and growers, hunters, fishermen, and I was eating some of their products. I was talking to beekeepers. I was enjoying the beauty of the Pacific. I was enjoying the beauty of the hills of Tuscany and Cayman Island. And at the end, it translates itself into cooking and into a great dish that has some relation with where I have been.
Could you describe the lunch that you had in the Cayman Islands? It appeared as if you were actually eating in the water.
We spent a day trying to catch some fish. At the end of the day, we caught a very tiny blackfin tuna, which barely fed both of us. And we got a couple of conch in the ocean, and then we went and parked the boat, and we were very close to the beach, and we sat in the water, put the beers in the sand to cool off in the water a little bit. And I cut the tuna into sashimis, and I made a conch ceviche, and we had a fantastic time.
Do you think that the perfect menu combines both dishes that are quite complex with a greater variation in ingredients coming together and other dishes which are extremely simple?
Well, a menu is an experience. So it's, you're not eating one dish, you're eating few dishes, and that makes you, let's suppose you have a couple of appetizers, a main course and a dessert, that's going to be your memories. You're not going to fixate only on one dish. And really, when you do the perfect pairing in terms of creating flavors and the perfect menu, what you try to do is to have sensations and flavors that are bringing you to a certain experience, almost like entering a roller coaster where you're going to go up in flavors and intensities, and you're going to go down. And then when you're going to be down, you're going to be surprised again, and you're going to find some spice and some acidity. And then you're going to go again to a softer flavor. And that, I think, it's what makes a dinner a great dinner.
It's the time of year when often at the beginning of the year, one is re-energized. What are some things that you are excited about touching and playing with in the kitchen?
Today, for instance, I went in the kitchen and I look at one dish. It's a red snapper dish, actually, with a chorizo sauce and it's a paprika sauce. And it was served with tapioca cooked in squid ink. It was very, very successful. People loved it. But today I had a different idea and I thought we should keep the sauce and change the garnish and get rid of the tapioca and do some fideos. Fideos are angel hair pasta that are toasted in Catalonia, it's near Barcelona, and they cook it almost like a paella. So tonight the snapper is not any longer the snapper that we had actually today at the beginning of the lunch. So we enjoy always the quiet times and the beginning of the year to reinvent ourselves. It always comes back to enhancing the experience for the client.
Eric Repair is the chef of the highly acclaimed restaurant Le Bernardin in New York. His latest book is Avec Eric. Coming up after this short break, Gustavo Arellano will take us on a tour of Santa Ana's Lonchera Lane in Orange County. That's next. You're listening to Good Food. I can remember exactly the very first time I ever tasted Mexican hot chocolate. I think I must have been around 7 or 8. It was at a restaurant in Echo Park called Casa de Ibarra. And I thought I had died and gone to heaven. I'm sure I burnt the whole roof of my mouth. So I'm really happy to have our pal Nancy Zaslavsky with me today.
Hey, Evan, it's great to be here with you, as always.
And of course, I did burn my mouth once again on a beautiful, very rich, thick cup of hot chocolate.
This is a chocolate that I love. It's made by an American company. I'm not promoting this. It's not my my business or anything, but it's called Taza, T-A-Z-A, and the folks are in Massachusetts, of all places. I love it because it's totally organic. Not only the cacao beans, but the sweetener and the canela, the true Ceylon cinnamon that's used in Mexico. And it's made using Mexican stone ground mills in Massachusetts. And it's now available all over the country. I've fallen in love with this stuff. As you know, Mexican chocolate is a whole lot different than the stuff we get here in the United States, or even the gorgeous, thick chocolate drink that you have in Paris, you know, in the fancy tea shops where you...
That's almost like pudding.
Oh, it is. It's liquid. It's hot chocolate pudding. I mean, it's hard to drink it so thick. Mexican chocolate is so different.
We're talking, of course, about a chocolate that's meant just for drinking and usually drinking hot. Describe how it comes. It comes in a very particular way in these little tablets.
Yes, because the way that it's made is the cacao beans are toasted and it's ground in a stone grinder with sugar and usually cinnamon, sometimes even toasted almonds in Oaxaca, where I love to go for Day of the Dead. Taza, it comes very close to that. It doesn't have the almonds. It just has the canela. But boy, that texture and the flavor is right on.
Where in L.A. did you find the Taza brand?
I got it in that new Mexican bakery, the Monarch Bakery on Wilshire and 13th Street. But I know that you could buy it all over the place. I've even seen it in my neighborhood Starbucks.
So once we have the tablet of Mexican chocolate, whatever brand we buy, how do we go about preparing it into the drink?
Well, I found the easiest way for me is to take one or two or how many tablets you need to make 1.5 cups. Más o menos. Okay, this is Mexican home cooking. It doesn't have to be perfect. Some people like it stronger. Some people like it less chocolatey. About 1.5 cups chopped up. Put a little bit of water or milk in the bottom of a pan and heat it slightly. Just bring it up to a simmer. Dump in all the chocolate at once. Stir it up. until the chocolate is melted and pour in the rest of the 1 quart of liquid.
And one of the things I have to say that I love to do is get a tea masala at the Indian grocery store, which is just ground up spices. It has no sugar, nothing in it. So it's the sweet spices along with a little bit of black pepper. And I just add that a little bit to my cup and it gives it a bit more punch.
Ooh, how international.
I know. My little fusion in a cup.
Well, I like to sprinkle a little bit of pure Ceylon cinnamon on top. Even if the chocolate does have cinnamon in it, I think that adds a nice touch to it. I never, ever, ever use the type of cinnamon sticks that the cassia that we use in the United States, you know, to stir hot toddies and whatnot at Christmas time. That's a completely different animal.
Yeah, that's the hard. Mm-hmm. It's harder. The canela is very soft.
Yes, it's the true Ceylon cinnamon. It has a compound in it called eugenol. It's the same one that gives cloves their distinctive aroma, that's why it's just more fragrant than the cinnamon that we're used to putting in pumpkin pie.
Do you ever do anything else with it? Do you ever melt it and incorporate it into other dishes?
Well, of course, for mole. I've in my second book, Meatless Mexican Home Cooking, there's a wonderful recipe for mole brownies. I developed, gosh, I don't know how long ago that was.
That sounds wonderful.
Oh, my God, they're great. The thing that you have to do, the secret to that recipe is toasting the sesame seeds. It makes all the difference in the world.
Thank you so much, Nancy.
Hey, great to be here. Good to see you.
Nancy runs culinary tours to Mexico, including a trip to Oaxaca in November for Day of the Dead. We'll have a link to her trips and the recipe for mole brownies at kcrw.com/goodfood. Food trucks are a way of life here in Southern California, and they have been for a really long time. It's only recently they've received national attention because of their new gourmet offerings. Gustavo Arellano calls these newfangled trucks Lux Loncheras, loncheras being the word in Spanish for lunch trucks. Gustavo, of course, is a frequent guest here on Good Food. He's the food editor of the OC Weekly, and he lives in Santa Ana, home to Lonchera Lane.
We're in Main Street, Santa Ana, the main corridor for the county seat of Orange. Main Street is the longest street in Santa Ana. It spans the entire city. But from 17th Street all the way down to, say, Warner Avenue, it's Lonchera Lane. On the side streets from Main, you see at least 20 different taco trucks, 20 different loncheras, selling all sorts of food. So what we're going to do is talk to some of the best taco trucks. So right now we're here at a taco truck that calls itself Hot Taco, but it sells specifically birria, the great stew of Jalisco and central Mexico. And here specifically, they sell birria de chivo, in other words, goat stew. They sell it every single day. They're here from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., and we're on the corner of Main Street and 15th Street at Hot Taco, which sells birria de chivo, goat stew. I'm going to order a birria taco right now because they sell birria in burritos, they sell birrias as a stew, they sell birria as a taco, and they also sell other dishes, but you're here for the birria. Orange County, for the most part, we're just going through the Lux Lonchera craze where people are getting into taco trucks. But the only real taco truck culture is here in Santa Ana, mostly because Santa Ana is such a Latino city. And it didn't come easily. In 2006, there was a lawsuit filed by a taco truck that we're going to talk to soon that established the right for taco trucks to park in one place from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. That's their right, as by the law. Before the city of Santa Ana wanted to sue these taco trucks, they wanted to fine them, and they also wanted to institute laws that would have them just park in one spot for half an hour and then move. These loncheros, of course, sued them. They argued that they would have no business if they had to move every half hour, and an Orange County Superior Court judge agreed with them. Therefore, now what you'll see on these side streets of Main Street in Santa Ana is taco trucks being here from the morning through the night. Here at Hot Taco, you see the sign, Abierto 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., open 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. So we have here then a taco de birria de chivo. You have the meat, some cilantro, radishes on the side, also onion in it. I'm squeezing the lemon in it right now. The tortilla, you have these little burnt crisps in it. The tortilla itself is crispy, but it's still pliable. One of the best birrias in Orange County because it's juicy. It keeps all that jugo, the its own juices. They just cook it in its juices. They roast it. It's really stringy. And, of course, goat, that gaminess that is just so sweet, such a powerful flavor. The juice is just spilled on the plate. It's this nice liquid orange, almost like transmission fluid, but so much better. We're now at Mariscos Los Corales, which is on the corner of Main and Pine Street. Mariscos Los Corales, they sell seafood, mariscos, Nayarit style. Nayarit is a state on the Pacific coast in Mexico, famous for its ceviche, famous for its aguachile. And this is actually a very famous restaurant in Santa Ana. It's been around for a couple of decades, but this taco truck has also been here for a while. So what we're going to order now is aguachile, which is a full shrimp marinated in lime juice, topped with a green salsa that will fry you, along with red onions and cucumbers and slices of tomatoes. So that's what we're going to order right now.
Hola. ¿Me da un aguachile, por favor? Gracias.
¿Para qué?
Okay, what's your name? ¿Cuál es su nombre?
Silverio.
Usted está, we're here, Silverio, he's with Mariscos Los Corales. Es todo estilo Nayarit, ¿verdad?
Sí, es todo origen de Nayarit, de allá de las raíces de... Los huicholes,
he says it's from the state of Nayarit, which is on the Pacific coast, mostly from the huicholes, which are the Indians of the region. There's illustrations of the traditional huichol dress, and he just invites everyone to come in. Usted, explíquele a la gente que está escuchando cómo es el aguachile. Explain to everyone what aguachile is.
El aguachile es muy originario de ahí, de Nayarit.
So aguachile, basically, it's like ceviche. You put it in lime juice. You put onions on it. And its trademark is a green salsa, which it's not going to fry your brains. I know I said that earlier, but it has this really great flavor to it. Really great, just very, very, very piquant. ¿Cuántos años tienen aquí? How many years do you have here?
Como 10 años. Mis hermanos, lógico, tienen restaurant y unas loncheras que andamos por aquí trabajando.
So it's his brothers that own the restaurant, Mariscos Los Corales, which has a brick-and-mortar location. Then he's in charge of this taco truck right here, this lonchera. Gracias, Silverio.
Ale, gracias.
We're now on Main and Chestnut at Los Reyes del Elote Asado, the Roasted Corn Kings. And this is where you can buy your roasted corn on the cob and also esquite, which is a type of corn stew, one of the oldest dishes still around from Mexico. This dish predates the Aztecs, and we're going to try that right now.
¿Me da un esquite asado, por favor?
So I'm about to eat esquite asado, roasted esquite. Esquite is it's kind of like a mixture of different things, but with corn kernels. So this one in particular, it's made with epazote, has some chile de árbol, butter, salt. I also asked for mayonnaise and some queso cotija, nice and crumbly. And individual corn kernels all mixed up. Wow, the mayonnaise in this is really, really tart, which I usually don't like mayonnaise, but here it's just amazing. The corn is roasted. It's not too spicy right now, but eventually the chile de árbol always gives you that extra kick. The way they serve it here, just for $3, you get it in a cup, but it's absolutely compacted, all these corn kernels on top. And you kind of mix it up with the mayonnaise and the cheese, which is on top, and you just eat your way through it. And then the salsa just kind of dribbles through. I can't wait till the end when everything just condenses into this beautiful juice. Okay, ¿cuál es su nombre? What's your name?
Armando Herrera.
He's one of the kings of the roasted corn. He's one of the two brothers that runs this spot. ¿Ustedes de dónde son de México?
Nosotros somos del estado de Puebla.
Puebla, México. Y el esquite es muy tradicional de Puebla, ¿verdad? El esquite es very traditional from Puebla.
Claro, sí. Allá para el lado del sur de Puebla, todo aquel rumbo se le llama esquite.
So he's talking about how in Puebla it's called esquite. You get the corn kernels, you roast them on a comal. And up here in the rest of Mexico, it's usually called like a cóctel de elote, just a corn cocktail. Here's where you put the mayonnaise, the cheese, and the like. Ustedes son los únicos que venden aquí. This is the only taco truck in Orange County that sells esquite. Gracias.
A ustedes muchas gracias.
Se lo agradezco.
Gracias.
Sabrosísimo.
Gracias, gracias.
Gracias, gracias. Loncheras in Orange County, they're really relegated to two places. The construction sites, at least historically, now you have the new taco trucks. Historically, they're relegated to construction sites and to Santa Ana. Most of the other cities in Orange County, they don't have a lonchera tradition because none of the other cities are as heavily Mexican as Santa Ana is. And also in Santa Ana, here they have rights to be on the streets from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. We're going right now to I call it the pink taco truck, but it's called Alebrijes. And this guy that we're going to talk to right now, he sued the city of Santa Ana, him and some other loncheros, for the right to be on the streets of Santa Ana 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. on one particular location, and that's it. And so as you go down Main, then, you want to just look on the different side streets from Main. And most of them I've tried. We're just going to the best ones. But if you're ever interested, you could really try it. You see these taco trucks, almost three per block, one following another on the different streets, all of them focusing on different dishes. And so they're not really competitors. If you want your seafood, you go to Mariscos Los Corales. If you want your birria, you go to Hot Taco. Right now, we're going to go to Alebrijes, which is, it sells Mexico City style food, but everyone goes here for the taco acorazado. We are at the most famous lonchera in Orange County. It's Alebrijes Grill. It's on Main and Cubbin, and it's famous for two things. Number one, it's Cadillac pink, bright, bright pink, sears your retinas. But it's also famous for a dish called the taco acorazado, which is, it translates as a battleship taco. We've talked about it on Good Food, Evan and I, and it's a taco that's basically as long as your hand and as wide as your hand, with milanesa, breaded beef cutlet. It has a nopal asado, grilled cactus. It has rice. It has onions. It is the most amazing taco you will ever have. We made a list this year. The top 100 dishes in Orange County, taco acorazado here at Alebrijes is number one. It is number one. I have to go back. We're all busy, but you could spend an entire day here in Santa Ana, just off Main Street, and try the different loncheras. I mean, some of my favorite ones we'd even get to. I didn't get to Ruben's Tacos y Mulitas, which sells these massive mulitas, and it has a sister taco truck that sells nothing but fish tacos. We didn't get to Ricas Gorditas. That's closer to St. Anne's Church off Main Street. Ruben's is behind the Pep Boys on 1st and Main Street. There's another place that sells 50 cent tacos. There's so many different loncheras. For Good Food, I've been Gustavo Ariano. Yum, yum, yum.
I am so excited to announce that I'm coming to Orange County for our next Good Food Happy Hour. On March 10th, come meet me and Gustavo Ariano for a drink at the Crosby in Santa Ana. We'll have some special discounts and some great giveaways. Full details, including the exact address, is at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or from kcrw.com/goodfood. Our blog has pictures, recipes, and information on all of today's guests there, too. Good Food's produced and edited by Harriet Ells. Our segment producers are Jillian Ferguson, Candace Moyer, and Laurel Garcia. Ronnie Mickelson mixes the show. Gary Messia chooses our music. Thanks to Becky Nelson, Bob Carlson, and Connie Alvarez. I'm Evan Kleiman. I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.